Good morning.
I think I'm on. Yes, no? Yes, I'm on. All right. You know, as we thank you for joining us again this morning. You know, if you are just coming in, we are studying in the book of Luke, and we're going to be in Luke chapter 7 this morning. Luke chapter 7 as we study the word. Luke is in the New Testament. It's one of the bigger books in the New Testament. So if you flip in the last like third of the Bible, you should see it pop out there, Luke chapter 7. And over the last few weeks, if you take Easter out of there, it was like the last 3 weeks, we've been looking at Jesus' sermon. If you look back at chapter 6, starting at verse 20, all the way through the end of chapter 6, which is verse 49, it's this long sermon of Jesus. We spent 3 weeks looking at it. And the first part of that sermon was where Jesus was talking about the hard attitude that was necessary if someone was going to, for someone to genuinely follow him as one of his disciples. And he speaks about, blessed are the poor. He talks about this destitute poverty that we need to recognize in ourselves and in our spirits that drives us to come to God empty-handed, looking to him only for our provision and support. Blessed are the poor. And then he speaks about blessed are those who hunger, who refuse to be satisfied on any of the things of this world, but look to God alone to be the one who satisfies. And then he speaks about blessed are those who mourn our sin and who mourn our brokenness and who mourn this world that we live in and look for the coming kingdom of Christ. He says, and if you're one of those people, then he speaks about one more path of blessing, and he says, and blessed are you when you're mistreated for my name's sake. That there is a cost with following Jesus. So he speaks about that hard attitude and the cost. And then he went into talking about how we're to live as his followers in this world. And as his followers, and this was the last 2 weeks, we're to live reflecting the love and mercy that God has for this world. And it's a hard thing, if you've been here over the last few weeks as we've talked about those things, to really live out what it means to love people like God loves them, to love them selflessly, looking for their good, without self-protection, and seeking to be a blessing to even your enemies. It's hard enough for us to genuinely love those who love us, let alone love those who hate us. And then he goes into showing mercy, that we need to, out of that same love, have this heart of mercy that seeks to spare and to serve those people that have wronged us. Mercy is something that flows from the wounded to the wounder and releases them from the penalty that they justly deserve. And Jesus says, if you're going to be my follower, you need to reflect the love and mercy that God has for all people. And then he says he warns them at the very end of his sermon. He warns them and he says, don't be like blind guides. He says, if one blind person leads another blind person, they're both going to fall into a pit. And he says that if you're following a certain teacher, you're going to become like that teacher, whether you like it or not. So you better make sure that you're following a guide that knows where they're going and you're following a teacher that knows what they're talking about, because if you don't, you'll be like a man who builds his house on the sand, and when the storm comes, wiped it out. And it says, and the ruin of that house was great. And what Jesus says when he talks about that is that it's in chapter 6, verse 46. Listen to what he says. And why do you call me Lord, Lord, and do not do what I say? Everyone who comes to me and hears my words and acts upon them, I will show you whom he is like. He is like a man building a house who dug deep and laid a foundation upon a rock. And when the flood rose, the torrent burst against that house and could not shake it because it was well built. If you think about that, that's a pretty bold claim for Jesus to make after he had just said that, like, hey, don't follow blind guides, don't follow ignorant teachers, but listen to me. Because if you come to me and learn from me and follow me, your life will stand. And if you don't, your life will be ruined. You know, as we get into the text today, what happens is immediately after that, we're going to see two separate incidents in the life of Jesus where he demonstrates really the same things that illustrate the things that he's been talking about here. They're going to illustrate the kind of faith that causes Jesus himself to marvel. Have you ever wondered that? Like, what kind of faith is it that causes God to marvel or wonder about? There's not very many things, I think, that the scriptures would say cause Jesus to do that. You know, we would think maybe it's kind of faith that moves mountains or that starts orphanages or does all of this, and you might be surprised at what Jesus marvels at when it comes to faith. You know, and then the other part to it is as he talks about this claim that you need to follow him, is we're going to see another incident in his life that declares like how great Jesus' authority is. So our sermon's really going to break out into two sections. It's in verses 1 through 10. We're going to see Jesus marveling at faith, and we're going to see Jesus magnifying his authority. Jesus marveling at faith, verses 1 through 10, and Jesus magnifies his authority, verses 11 through 17. So let me go ahead and read verses 1 through 17, then we'll pray and get into the text together. Luke chapter 7, verse 1. When he had completed all his discourse in the hearing of the people, he went to Capernaum. And a certain centurion's slave, who was highly regarded by him, was sick and about to die. And when he heard about Jesus, he sent some Jewish elders asking him to come and save the life of his slave. And when they had come to Jesus, they earnestly entreated him, saying, "He is worthy for you to grant this to him, for he loves our nation, and it was he who built us our synagogue." Now Jesus started on his way with them. And when he was already not far from the house, the centurion sent friends saying to him, "Lord, do not trouble yourself further, for I am not worthy for you to come under my roof. For this reason I did not even consider myself worthy to come to you. But just say the word, and my servant will be healed. For I too am a man under authority, with soldiers under me. And I say to this one, 'Go,' and he goes. And to another, 'Come,' and he comes. And to my slave, 'Do this,' and he does it." Now when Jesus heard this, he marveled at him and turned and said to the multitude that was following him, "I say to you, not even in Israel have I found such great faith." And when those who had been sent returned to the house, they found the slave in good health. And it came about soon afterwards that he went to a city called Nain, and his disciples were going along with him, accompanied by a large multitude. Now he approached the gate of the city, and behold, a dead man was being carried out, the only son of his mother, and she was a widow, and a sizable crowd from the city was with her. And when the Lord saw her, he felt compassion for her and said to her, "Do not weep." And he came and touched the coffin, and the bearers came to a halt, and he said, "Young man, I say to you, arise." And the dead man sat up and began to speak, and Jesus gave him back to his mother, and fear gripped them all. And they began glorifying God, saying, "A great prophet has risen among us, and God has visited his people." And this report concerning him went out over all Judea and in all the surrounding district. Let's pray. Father, I thank you for your word, and I thank you for Jesus Christ, who is the one who brings in all of the blessings of your kingdom, who brings in healing and life, and has the authority to do so. And we would just ask that you would accomplish that for us this morning, that you would bring healing and life to us by your Spirit through your word as you work in the hearts of your people. Please empower me to speak your word. It's something that's way beyond me, and help us to hear it as well. I pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen. You know, as we get into verses 1 through 10, you know, there's this incident with the centurion. It talks about in verse 1, how Jesus was entering back into Capernaum, which was kind of his base of operations for this ministry that he had up in Galilee. And as he went there, he's met by a delegation of people that had been sent to him by a Roman centurion. Now, for those of you that don't know what a Roman centurion is, it's important that we have a little bit of detail on this. First of all, a Roman centurion would have been like the epitome of a man's man, right? The Roman centurions, the word centurions means like a commander of a century. He commands 100 men. And they were generally promoted up out of the ranks of the legions of Roman soldiers. And so the centurions were people who had proven themselves, in battle and in other ways, and had earned this title of centurion, and they commanded 100 people. So this was a guy who all of us would like look up to, right? He's a man's man. You know, he was also, as a centurion, they were also really well paid. It was actually quite a bit. They were paid like 17 to 20 times more than just the average worker would have been paid. And so these were wealthy people who got paid well, who got a bigger choice of the spoils when they conquered, a bigger portion of the spoils when they conquered a place. And so, so he was wealthy. You know, we also find out that, as a member of the Roman army, he's not a Jew. That's important as the story unfolds, that he's a foreigner. We don't know exactly where from. He could have been from another nation, but as the story unfolds, it's clear that he's not a Jew. He is a member of the Roman army. And as a member of the Roman army, he is a commander in the of the occupying army that's oppressing the nation of Israel. Think about that for a second. So this Roman centurion is like is commanding 100 men in the city of Capernaum there, and the Roman Empire is an occupying army over the people of Israel. It would be like if Iraq invaded us, and this was one of the sergeants in the Iraqi army that's coming to Jesus, right? This is not a person that normally any affection from the Jews would flow towards. He is a man who has power and authority and has proven himself, and he sends a delegation to Jesus because he's got a slave that's dear to him that's about to die. He's hanging by a thread. And so he sends Jewish leaders to Israel, to Jesus. And listen to what the dialogue is. And it's an interesting dialogue because as the Jewish leaders talk to Jesus, it reveals something about their heart that's really important for us as the story unfolds. Listen to what happens starting at verse 3. And when he heard about Jesus, he sent some Jewish elders, these are the respected leaders in the city, asking him to come and save the life of his slave. And when they had come to Jesus, they earnestly entreated him, saying, "He is worthy for you to grant this to him, for he loves our nation, and it was he who built our synagogue." So there's a couple of things. There's a couple of things that reveals that their words reveal about their hearts. Jesus actually says that in his sermon, that our mouth speaks that which fills our heart. And the first thing is that I think they reveal that they think Jesus is just the same as them. That Jesus is motivated by the same petty jealousies and prejudices and everything that they as Jews were motivated by. Because it says that they were earnestly entreating him. They came and they were begging Jesus, like there was a seriousness and an imploring and like, please, please, please come and do this for him. As if their assumption would be that Jesus wouldn't do it because he's a Roman. You know, apparently they missed the part in his sermon where he says, back in chapter 6, whoever hits you on the cheek, offer him the other also. Whoever takes away your coat, do not withhold your shirt from him either. Give to everyone who asks of you, and whoever takes away what is yours, do not demand it back. And just as you want people to treat you, treat them in the same way. Do good to those who hate you. Right? That's what Jesus had just finished preaching, and yet they probably thought it's going to take some convincing to get Jesus to do what he just preached, right? And so what they do is they're earnestly imploring Jesus, and then they actually kind of show, they tip their hand again, because they say, "He is worthy." We know he's a Roman. We know that he's part of this occupying army, but he's not as bad as the rest of them. Two reasons. One, because he loves our nation. There's an affection that this Roman guy has for the Jewish people. Where that came from, we don't know, but the Jewish leaders affirm it, that he has this affection for the Jewish people, and he built us a church building. Right? That's pretty funny, if you think about it. He built us our synagogue, is what they're saying. So here's this guy, and the Jewish people are saying, you know what, Jesus, this guy is worthy for you to respond to, because he gave us a bunch of money. And he has affection towards us. He's a friend of ours, and he gave us a bunch, so you should pay him back by doing this thing for him. Jesus doesn't show any response to that, but he begins on his way to go heal this slave. You know, we have to ask ourselves a question though, because I think, you know, as crazy as that sounds, like that they're appealing to Jesus to go because of how much money he gave, or because of the fact that he's friendly to them? And based on those things, he's worthy for Jesus to respond to them? You know, how often do we think that our religious activity somehow makes us worthy for Jesus to respond to us? Or maybe the flip side of it, if you're not good at good religious activity, right? How often does our lack of good action in our life make us feel like we're not worthy for Jesus to respond to us, and we shrink back in shame? You know, either way, what the Jewish leaders are indicating is that their belief is that God's response to heal this person is based on the performance of the person that's making the request. And the reality is that our performance will never be good enough, and Jesus didn't come to save good performing people. In fact, flip back with me to Luke chapter 6, verse 34. Luke chapter 6, verse 34. At the inauguration of Jesus' public ministry. Did I say 34? Is that right? Go back to chapter 6. That is right, but I'm going someplace else. Chapter 6, verse 3. Go to chapter 6, verse 3. I don't know what I was thinking when I put that in my notes. I'm going the wrong direction. But here, chapter 6, verse 3. And Jesus answering them said, oh, that's not chapter 6, 3. Where'd you find this guy that's preaching to you this morning? That's the wrong verse, though. Go to chapter 4. We'll just skip chapter 6 altogether. Go to chapter 4. Chapter 4, verse 18. I think that'll be right. This is at the inauguration of Jesus' public ministry. He says this, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor. He sent me to proclaim release to the captives and recovery of sight to the blind, to set free those who are downtrodden, and to proclaim the favorable year of the Lord." He says that favorable year, this time of God's blessing and all of the millennial promises of God and of this time of blessing and plenty and celebration and joy doesn't come to those who are good performing people. It comes to the poor, to the downtrodden, to the captives that need release. And the Jewish leaders are thinking that Jesus has come to give those blessings to people who buy them a church building. And we do the same thing. We often do the same thing and we forget that how absolutely generous God is to us. That when Jesus says, that's where chapter 6 verse 34 came in. Go to chapter 6 verse 34. It's been a rough morning for me, I guess. Chapter 6 verse 34. When Jesus says, I'll start at verse 33. And if you do good to those who do good to you, what credit is that to you? For even sinners do the same. And if you lend to those from whom you expect to receive, what credit is that to you? Even sinners lend to sinners in order to receive back the same amount. But love your enemies, do good, and lend, expecting nothing in return, and your reward will be great, for you will be sons of the Most High, for he himself is kind to ungrateful and evil men. You know, that command to love your enemies, do good, and lend isn't just a command that tells us what our responsibility is as followers of Christ. It is revelation from God about who he is. For he himself is kind to ungrateful and evil men. He does good and lends and expects nothing in return. God is absolutely gracious and merciful. And apparently the Jews forgot that. The Jews thought that they had to somehow earn it. And what we need to come to grips with is that the cross is this absolute, unshakable proof that God loves us and his mercy has no limits. When we come to God like the Jews did with a sense of entitlement because we think we've somehow proven how worthy we are, or we shrink back with them with a sense of fear because we don't think we've performed well enough, either way, we've proven that we've forgotten the cross. Because that's at the cross that God's grace and love and generosity and mercy flows forth. And we could never perform well enough. We could never perform well enough. So they're approaching the house and we come to a second delegation. It's interesting. A second group of people comes to meet Jesus. And it says as they're approaching the house, not far off from that house, verse 6, "Now when Jesus started on his way with them, and when he was already not far from the house." You know, so apparently there's this huge multitude with Jesus, and they're all following Jesus, and they're approaching this centurion's home. And then all of a sudden, this group of friends leaves the centurion's home and approaches Jesus. It's really interesting that the main character in the story besides Jesus is a centurion, and the centurion never makes an appearance in the story. We never actually meet him. And he never actually meets Jesus as the story goes on, and we'll see why in just a minute. The centurion never appears. He sends a second delegation, and these are his friends. And when his friends speak, they don't reveal their own heart. They reveal the centurion's heart. Because look what they say. The centurion sent friends saying to him, "Lord, do not trouble yourself further, for I am not worthy for you to come under my roof. For this reason, I did not even consider myself worthy to come to you, but just say the word and my servant will be healed. It's interesting. If you look at the quote from the Jewish leaders up above, the Jewish leaders are speaking for the centurion. They say, he is worthy. He's our friend. You should do this for him. But when the friends come to Jesus, they're actually quoting the centurion. They reveal the centurion's heart because they quote in the first person, I am not worthy. Right? That's not the centurion speaking. That's his friends, but they're speaking for him. And his response to Jesus is exactly the opposite of the Jewish leaders. He's like, stop. Don't come any closer to my house because I am not worthy to come to you. Oh, no, I'm sorry. Lord, don't trouble yourself any further, for I am not worthy for you to come under my roof. I am not worthy for you to come into my home. Stop there. You've come close enough. You know, that it's interesting. That word worthy there is a different word than it's used up above when the Jewish leaders said he is worthy. This word means that I am, it has this idea of like, I'm insufficient. I don't measure up, or, as you apply it to this circumstance, it could be something like, I'm not man enough for you to come to my house, Jesus. I'm this commander in the Roman army, but I'm not man enough for you to even come into my house. I am insufficient. I don't measure up to you. And then he says, and if you have the ESV, it reads a little bit differently. Then he says, and I didn't even consider myself worthy to come to you. You can't come to my house because I'm not worthy, and I'm so unworthy, I couldn't even come to you. The ESV reads, I didn't presume to come to you, I think is how it reads. The word there is actually the verb word of the same adjective that the Jewish leaders said. When they said he is worthy, it's the same word, but it's used as a verb, which means I don't consider myself worthy or deem myself worthy or presume myself to be worthy. That's where the ESV kind of gets that language. So it's this idea of, as I reflect on myself, I know that I'm not worthy to even come and make this request to you, Jesus. So I sent a delegation. I'm not even going to appear in the story. I'm just going to stay at my house. I don't measure up to you. And then he gives the reason why. Listen to what he says. For this reason, I do not even consider myself worthy to come to you, but just say the word and my servant will be healed. For I too am a man under authority, with soldiers under me, and I say to this one, go, and he goes, and to another, come, and he comes, and to my slave, do this, and he does it. So two parts to that statement that he's making. He's, first of all, and this is important, it's easy to read right over this, I too am a man under authority. What the centurion is saying about himself is that he doesn't have authority in and of himself. He has authority because he's part of the chain of command of the Roman army, and his authority flows down to him from Caesar himself. I am under the authority of Caesar, right? And there's soldiers under my authority. And so when I speak from with the authority of Caesar himself. And so guess what? People do what I say. If I tell a soldier go or come, they go. If I tell a slave do it, they do it, because I am part of this chain of command that goes all the way up to the top. But even as great as that chain of command is, Jesus, I'm not worthy to even come talk to you, because... And he recognizes something, and he's making a comment about Jesus. I too am a man under authority. He's like, you know what, Jesus? I know that you're in a different chain of command than I am. And that you don't receive your authority from Caesar. You receive your authority from God himself. You are acting as a servant of the creator of all of the universe. You're under his authority. And when you speak, Jesus, guess what? I know what will happen. Whatever will transpire. If you say, just speak the word and my servant will be healed, I have absolute confidence it will be healed. You don't even have to come into my house. Just will it and it will happen. And the centurion has this deep understanding of who Jesus is. He has this deep understanding of Jesus' power, and he has this great faith that Jesus doesn't even have to be present. Up until now, if you guys remember the story going through Luke, is that as anybody that would touch Jesus would be healed. And that people were always fighting in and trying to touch him, and that's why he had to get out on a boat, because everybody wanted to touch him and receive healing. And he's like, no, I'm not worthy to even come close to you. But I don't need to touch you, Jesus, because you're in this chain of command from God himself. You speak the word, it'll happen. So Jesus, as he's approaching the house, it says this. It says, and he marveled at him. Verse 9. Now when Jesus heard this, he marveled at him. I almost can picture in my mind maybe Jesus like looking past the friends and looking down the road to the guy's house and maybe seeing a shadowy figure in the door. I don't know. You know, like, cause the guy's not even wanting to come out. And there's this sense of like wonder, right? That Jesus is like, man, that is unbelievable. The kind of faith this guy has. His understanding of me is unbelievable. It's marvelous. And then he turns away from the guy and turns to the crowd. And then he says to the crowd, he uses this man as an illustration and he says, I say to you, not even in Israel have I found such great faith. So here is this guy who's not even a Jew, who's part of this oppressive power, who's part of the Roman army, who's really probably despised by most of the people there, who doesn't hang his confidence in Jesus on his own religious performance, but just declares and calls out and cries out for God's mercy because of his own unworthiness. And Jesus says, if you want to have faith, you need to have a faith like that, because that is the greatest faith I've ever seen. And not even among all of you people, nation of Israel, have I seen faith like this Roman has. Not even in all of Israel. He's comparing the faith of the centurion with the religious works of the Jews that they talked about when they made their request. Because for them it was all about Jesus owing them something because of their performance. So what kind of faith does Jesus marvel at? First of all, you know, it's this idea of this faith that calls out and casts ourselves completely on his love and mercy. It's the kind of faith that Jesus says inherits the kingdom back in chapter 6, verse 20. Blessed are you who are poor, for yours is the kingdom of heaven. The centurion wasn't poor financially, but he was poor in spirit. He recognized in deep humility that he had nothing that would obligate God to himself. In fact, just the opposite. His whole life was a life, his heart was one in which he deserved God's judgment, not his blessing. But he believed that maybe Jesus was serious when he said that I love my enemies. And that the poor in spirit are those who inherit the kingdom. You know, there's this other part that is easy for us to miss, is that sense of unworthiness in him, though, also had this deep conviction about God's mercy. Because as unworthy as he felt, he still had the confidence to go and cry out to the Lord. And I think oftentimes for us, we get so wrapped into our religious performance and we gotta do the right things and otherwise God's mad at us and God doesn't owe, you know, whatever, that we forget that, you know, everything we are, everything we can be, everything that we receive from Christ is simply on the basis of his grace and mercy. And he freely gives to those who come to him. You don't have to earn it. He freely gives. You know, that sense of fear. You know, that sense of fear that we have, like, because I know in my own life I've struggled in the past, and I still struggle with it at times, with just this picture of God where God is like grumpy and stingy and a miser with his grace, and yeah, like he's willing to forgive me at times, but he does so begrudgingly, right? Anybody else ever feel that way? Yeah. We're like just like the Jews. Jesus is no different than me, right? Because I'm grumpy, right, Sophie? And stingy and don't agree. No, but the reality is that we often think that God is like us. And, you know, in the midst, later on in Luke chapter 12, listen to what Jesus says. Luke chapter 12, verse 32. Jesus is talking to his disciples about how they can come to God with all of their daily needs amidst all the pressures of this world and finances and all of those things. He just says this one statement I think is remarkable. He says this, Luke 12, 32. Do not be afraid, little flock, for the Father has chosen gladly to give you the kingdom. Did you hear that? Do not be afraid, little flock, for the Father has chosen gladly to give you the kingdom. You know, in the midst of all of the struggles that we have and all of the concerns that we have, and we feel like weak little flock of sheep, Jesus says, you know, don't be afraid, because God gladly gives his kingdom to the poor in spirit and to those who mourn and to those who are hungry and don't look for it anywhere else. You know, so if you're in that sense of religious, like, performance in your relationship with the Lord, just realize that the way to the Father is paved through the blood of the Son. It's not through your works. It's not through anything you can do. It's not through you keeping the law. It's because Jesus did it all for you. Don't be afraid, little flock. The Father has chosen gladly to give you the kingdom. You know, as we, the next situation as we move on to point two this morning, as we look at what happens next, it's almost as if Luke is including this account of what happens next in here to answer the question for us. Okay, well, the centurion recognized that Jesus is under the authority of God. Well, how much authority then does Jesus have? Is he like a centurion? Is he a chiliarch, which was the commander of the thousand? Is he like a general? Where does he fall in this chain of command from the Lord, right? Is he a prophet? Is he a good teacher? And so what we have is next is that Jesus comes up to this group of people. He's coming to the city of Nain, starting in verse 11. And it tells us that it came about soon afterwards that he went into a city called Nain, and his disciples were going along with him, accompanied by a large multitude. Now as he approached the gate of the city, behold, a dead man was being carried out, the only son of his mother, and she was a widow. And a sizable crowd from the city was with her. The only son of his mother, and she was a widow. You know, there's some emotional impact that we should feel in that expression, is that this woman has been left utterly alone. Her husband had passed away, and now her only child had passed away, and now she's alone, and she's carrying her son out on a pallet. The New American Standard reads coffin. It's more like a stretcher that they're carrying him out of the city. And Jesus comes up and sees this procession, and it says, you can see that Jesus, as this one with all authority, he's not a tyrant, but he's compassionate. Look what happens. It says, now as they, verse 13, and the Lord saw her and felt compassion for her and said to her, do not weep. So here's Jesus, moved by the sense of, like, feeling her loss, moved by love for her, is seeking to comfort her, and he's like, woman, please, please, please don't weep. Don't weep. Because he knows what he's about to do. It's interesting, in this story, there's no appeal to faith. Jesus is simply acting on his own initiative. Nobody asks him to raise this person from the dead. Jesus just comes up, and he acts on his own initiative, giving comfort and compassion to this woman. And then it says, verse 14, and he came up and he touched the coffin, and the bearers came to a halt. So here they are, they're carrying this, there's a procession. Jesus comes up to this woman and says, don't weep. And everybody's continuing to move on because he gotta get this taken care of. And so Jesus moves up and grabs hold of this pallet and stops it. And then what happens next is absolutely absurd if you think about it. Because what does Jesus do? He talks to the dead person. Look what he says. Young man, I say to you, arise. That's craziness, right? Get up. Days you're still young. There's work to be done. Get out of bed. And I'm sure everybody, when they're hearing that, they're like, who is this guy that's talking to this dead guy? And those thoughts are quickly dispelled of the lunacy of it all. Because in response to Jesus' word, and there's a sense of, like, power behind it, I say to you, arise, right? This guy sits up, and he starts to talk. That's what it says next. And the dead man sat up and began to speak, and Jesus gave him back to his mother. I wish Luke would have told us what he said. Like, that's like the big mystery, right? Clearly he didn't write the books that are all being circulated today about, like, 90 minutes, wherever, you know. He just got up, he began to speak, and Jesus, like, helps him down off of the stretcher, and in this act of love and provision for this woman, gives her back to him. Here, don't weep anymore. He's alive. I mean, instantly returned to life and health. The reaction of the crowd is like, as you can imagine, verse 16, fear gripped them all. And they began glorifying God, saying, a great prophet has arisen among us, and God has visited his people. There's two commands, there's two claims there about Jesus. The first one is a great prophet has arisen. It's really interesting because there's two of the biggest named prophets in the Old Testament, Elijah and Elisha. Elijah in particular, they both did a miracle where they healed the son for a mother. In fact, Elijah, who is probably like, you could make the argument, is probably viewed as the greatest prophet in the Old Testament, maybe aside from Moses himself. Elijah actually performed the exact same miracle. But in response to his request, the only son of a widow was raised to life. It's in 1 Kings chapter 17. 1 Kings chapter 17, starting at verse 20. You don't need to turn there. But the story was is that Elijah went and was living with this foreign widow. And God miraculously provided food for her during this time of famine because she took Elijah in. And then after that famine had kind of passed, her son dies when Elijah's still living in her house. And she gets upset and she's like, why did your God take my son away from me? Now I'm all alone. And then what happens is Elijah goes to this dead boy in 1 Kings 17 and begins to pray. And listen to what he says, verse 20. And he called to the Lord and said, oh Lord, my God, have you also brought calamity to the widow with whom I am staying by causing her son to die? Then he stretched himself out upon the child three times and called to the Lord and said, oh Lord, my God, I pray you, let this child's life return to him. So here you have Elijah like laying down on this child and just crying out to the Lord three times, Lord, please raise him from the dead. Please raise him from the dead. Please raise him from the dead, because this calamity has befallen this widow and she's left all alone. And he raises to life. And so the same thing happening here in Luke 7 would have like evoked all of those memories of that text in the minds of the Jews. And they're like, there's a prophet like Elijah among us. Elijah's gone. But they're missing something. When they call Jesus a prophet, a great prophet, that's true. He is a great prophet. He speaks for God, but he is so much more. And this story reveals it to us. Because what does Jesus not do in this story? He doesn't pray to anyone. He doesn't say, hey, God, please show mercy on this widow, raise this person to life. God is the one who has authority over life and death. And Jesus just walks up to the funeral procession, grabs hold of the pallet, and says himself, I say to you, get up. And the guy gets up and begins to speak, and he returns him to his mother. Jesus isn't a prophet. Jesus is God himself. Jesus is the one who has the authority to command life and death. And he speaks to a dead person, and the dead person raises. There's no need for prayer. Jesus himself possesses that authority. In fact, maybe they got a sense of that because the next statement they make is, God has visited his people. God has visited his people. And I think that was more like an idiom, which means like an expression that of this idea that God is visiting us through this prophet to do these great works, to deliver us once again, that God's presence is back with us through this person. And they, even though they declare that God has visited us, they don't really know what they're saying because they're using it figuratively. But you know what? It's literally true. God has visited them. In fact, if you look back in Luke, go back to Luke chapter 1, verse 68. Following the birth of John the Baptist, Zacharias prophesies, and he prophesies about the significance of John the Baptist. And the significance of John the Baptist is that he is paving the way for somebody else. And listen to what he says in verse 68. Blessed be the Lord God of Israel, because he has visited us and accomplished redemption for his people. Zacharias is like, you know what? God himself is about to arrive. And then he says that you, my child, are going to be like this one who paves the way for the Lord Yahweh himself to come. In fact, Jesus You know, we know that the Jews never really grasped what they were saying when they said God visited us, because if you flip over to Luke 19, Luke 19, starting at verse 42. Jesus is speaking to the Jews, and he says this: "If you had known this day, even you, the things that which make for peace, but now they have been hidden from your eyes, for the days will come upon you when your enemies will throw up a barricade against you and surround you and hem you in on every side, and they will level you to the ground and your children within you, and they will not leave in you one stone upon another, because you did not recognize the time of your visitation." You didn't figure it out when God came in the flesh and commanded the dead to rise in and of his own authority that God was with you. And because God, you didn't recognize it and you decided to kill him instead, and Jerusalem is going to be left without one stone on another. God has visited his people, and somebody greater than Elijah had come. Now, so what do we do with that this morning? Now, first of all, is that we need to recognize that Jesus has all authority. He wasn't just a prophet. He wasn't just a teacher. He was God in the flesh. He is risen from the dead, and he still rules today. You know what that means is this kind of faith that comes to Jesus is a faith like the centurion has, that comes to him in our brokenness and in our, without any dependence upon our works, casts ourselves on his grace and mercy, and recognizes that he has all authority in our life. That we declare Jesus Christ is Lord. In fact, in this text back in Luke chapter 7, it's interesting. For the first time in the entire book of Luke, in verse 13, it says, "And when the Lord saw her." It's the first time that Lord is, other people have called Jesus Lord in their dialogue. This is the first time Luke, as like the narrator, actually gives Jesus the title of Lord when he declares his authority over death itself by commanding the dead guy to rise. Jesus is Lord. He's the King, and we owe him all of our allegiance. You know, so if you're here and you're like struggling with your relationship with the Lord, just know the kind of faith that God marvels at isn't the kind of faith that does a bunch of stuff, that gives a bunch of money, that does all of those things, but it's the kind of faith that just comes in empty-handed and receives his life-giving mercy. And it's the kind of faith that recognizes, like the centurion did, that his chain of command goes all the way to the top. In fact, he is the top. Right? He's the one that does the will of the Father. He's the one that's been with the Father from the beginning. He's the one that is one essence with the Father, who is the perfect, you know, the writer of Hebrews tells us he's the perfect illustration of the Father. He's the carbon copy, the control alt C of God himself, right? He's not part of the chain of command. He is the commander. And we need to submit our lives to him. So Joel, why don't you come up to close us? But he's not a tyrant. He's one that's moved by compassion. He's one that marvels at the faith of his people. He's one that gives life. And so please just, you know, if you're here and you've struggled and you don't know where you stand before the Lord, know that you can receive grace and mercy and forgiveness and life from him if you just cry out to him in your brokenness. There's no reason to leave here under the judgment of your sin. There's no reason to leave here still thinking you need to be on that path of religious performance. There's no reason to be here thinking that there's anything that can get in the way of God's love for you if you've trusted in the finished work of Jesus on the cross. So Joel, as you close us, I just encourage you guys all to reflect on that, and I'll close us in a minute. Father, thank you for that song, and I guess just the simple words that encapsulate what the centurion illustrated for us, that all that we have is you, that we are not worthy for you to come into our house. We are not worthy to come to you. We're not worthy for sure to come into your house, and yet you were worthy for us. You are our life, and you're the one who calls us to yourself and who raises us from the dead so that we can love and follow you. So Father, I pray that you would work in our hearts and our minds
to love you with all of our heart, soul, mind, and strength, to not depend upon ourselves at all, but to depend completely on your Son. I pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.